Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Friday the 13th. I don't know whether that bothers you or not. I hesitate to admit that I probably would have a little bit of a little twinge about getting on an airplane. I would still do it, but it is Friday the 13th. It's Friday the 13th in the year 2020. So what could possibly go wrong? So does that kind of thing bother you, Benjamin Wittes? By the way, our special guest is Benjamin Wittes from Lawfare. The fact that it's Friday the 13th.
Well, so I didn't notice that it was Friday the 13th until you just pointed it out. No. But now that you've pointed it out, and I would say normally, no, it doesn't bother me at all. But it is the combination of Friday the 13th and 2020 is, you know, if there were ever an unlucky day, it must be today.
I should have, before we started this, I should have gone and checked what the status of the meteor. Remember that meteor was going to come right past the Earth right around now? Did it already miss us, or we still got a shot at it?
I don't know. Sweet meteor of death, this is your moment.
Yeah. So before we get started, this story, I went to bed last night having read the lead story in the Washington Post, and frankly, it just haunted me. And like the first three paragraphs, you know, this David Nakamura story. On Thursday, six American service members were killed in a helicopter crash during a peacekeeping mission in Egypt. Tropical storm Eta made landfall in North Florida, contributing to severe flooding. The number of Americans infected with the coronavirus continued at a record-setting pace, sending the stock market tumbling. At the White House, President Trump spent the day, as he has most others this week, sequestered from public view, tweeting grievances, falsehoods, and misinformation about the election results and about Fox News's coverage of him. Neither he nor his aides briefed reporters on the news of the day or reacted to Democratic leaders who accused Republicans of imperiling the pandemic response by refusing to accept reality over the election results. And here's the kicker paragraph. The contrast between the nation grappling with an ongoing global crisis and a president consumed with his own political problems highlighted a fundamental contradiction at the heart of Trump's assault on the integrity of the U.S. election system. He is leveraging the power of his office in a long-shot bid to stay in the job while ignoring many of the public duties that come with it. You know, if there was ever if there was ever just one of those moments where you had to make that fundamental choice, choosing country over party, this would be it. And maybe that's what's kind of so depressing, because you're seeing that this is the moment and it's not happening.
It's almost like he doesn't care about anything except himself.
That could possibly be true, but we have to give him a shot, right?
Yeah, you want to give him the opportunity to grow in the office. You keep hoping today is going to be the day that, as Van Jones once put it, he becomes president. And yet it never happens.
No, it hasn't. So I started my newsletter today by saying we really should be feeling better by now, because the election's over. Trump's defeated. The rest of the world, even China, has acknowledged it. Basically, the only people who haven't acknowledged are Vladimir Putin and the Republican Party. And America, you know, seems like ready to turn the page. But here we are. It's Friday the 13th, and we're still being held hostage by this petulant, selfish, and delusional man who's at the batshit crazy stage of denial. I mean, tweeting out these crazy, crazy things, which I want to get to in just a moment, because you have a great piece about how hard it is to overturn an election. Before we do this, we do a little palate cleanser, because I think I started off too dark here, and I just could. Here's a little sound clip. Joe Scarborough featured it this morning, and every voice you're about to hear is a Republican or a right-wing commentator from 2016. Every single voice you're about to hear is from November of 2016. Let's play this.
You have people out there calling for recounts that are unsubstantiated, based on no evidence. This was a legitimate election, and no one should question the fact that Donald Trump is the president-elect.
Hillary is on her sore loser tour, and now we have her going through recounts. You know what she needs to do? She needs to get over it. She lost. Yeah. Get out of the way and let Donald Trump be president.
Do you think the Democrats are sore losers? Yeah, I do.
The reality is they're a bunch of spoiled crybabies.
Newsflash for many of the partisan Democrats and those in the mainstream media who continue to try to delegitimize President-elect Trump's massive and historic win last month. The election's over. Hillary Clinton lost. You have to win 270 electoral votes to be elected president, and President-elect Trump actually got 306. This is all really just an effort to try to delegitimize the win.
The left's going to lie. The left's going to besmirch.
They're going nuts
crazy.
Now.
They can't accept the election results, let alone the fact that he's actually going to solve problems.
They have to decide whether they're going to interfere with him finishing his business, interfere with the peaceful transition, transfer of power to President-elect Trump and Vice President-elect Pence, or if they're going to be a bunch of crybabies and sore losers about an election that they can't turn around.
This is America. We live in a democracy. Everybody, when they woke up in the morning, is registered to vote, could go choose. So how about respecting the majority that also live here, and their vote should count?
Yeah. Brian, they're saying it's rigged. But they have absolutely no evidence that it's rigged.
I don't even think we should give him the time of day. Also, he's about to win. We know it's a matter of time, about to win Michigan officially. So that would put Donald Trump over the top with over 300 electoral votes. It was a blowout. I just wonder what these Democrats are doing, trying to convince their electoral representatives not to vote the way the people want.
There are six of them.
Now there's these states which have a recount.
We believe in free speech. We believe in accepting winners and not being sore losers.
They have no actual proof of voter fraud or any wrongdoing, and both the White House and the Wisconsin Elections Commission have both said zero evidence whatsoever. Now, what happened to the peaceful transition of power and supporting the incoming administration?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's like we've wandered into this permanent hall of mirrors, haven't we?
You know, it's almost unfair to hold people to things they said 4 years ago, because they're actually being entirely consistent. They were saying exactly what was convenient for Donald Trump then, and they're saying exactly what was is convenient for Donald Trump now.
That is the through line, which brings us to today, Friday the 13th. So Peter Navarro, who is the trade representative and an expert on everything, just ask him, he's an expert on everything, comes out and says they're planning on a second Trump term. Let's just play this.
Maria, we're moving forward here at the White House under the assumption that there will be a second Trump term. I think it's really important, before people's heads explode here, to understand that what we seek here is verifiable ballots, certifiable ballots, and an investigation into what are growing numbers of allegations of fraud under signed affidavits by witnesses. And my own view, looking at this election, we have what appears in some sense to be an immaculate deception.
Oh, I bet he felt proud about that. Okay, so Benjamin Wittes, you wrote, so it has come to this. President of the United States is trying to overturn the results of a national election he unambiguously lost, with a combination of petulant whining. Oh, say, this is a good day for petulant whining, spiteful and flailing executive action, and magic. No, it is ultimately not going to work, at least not if working is defined as allowing President Trump to maintain power in the face of the express voter will. But it is working better than I would have believed possible. Okay, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that we are more than a week after the last vote was cast, and a week and a half now, and it is clear who won the election. And when I say clear, I don't mean mostly clear. I don't mean a little bit clear. I don't mean, you know, it's coming into focus. I mean, we know the damn answer.
Yeah.
And the White House, in official statements, is denying that reality and actively planning for, at least in appearance, for a second term, both in its public statements. The Washington Post has reported that it is vetting political appointees for a second term. It has instructed agencies not to cooperate, at least not yet, with any transition. And so it is acting like there is going to be a continuity of government. And by the way, Mike Pompeo, though people keep saying he was joking, said this explicitly, that they were planning for, a peaceful transition to a second term of the Trump administration. And so if you had asked me a year ago, would it be possible for, could you imagine a situation in which the president of the United States loses unambiguously his bid for reelection, and nonetheless, the formal organs of the White House, act as though that reality isn't reality and as though they are heading to a re-inauguration, I would have said, come now, don't be silly. And yet that is exactly what's happening.
I think that's what's a little bit disconcerting. And over the last 4 years, we saw how challenging it was to fact check the president. Now we've moved on to a different phase where it's the reality check. We're having the ultimate reality check with the coronavirus, with the unambiguous results from the election, and you have the president just defying reality. And that's what's extraordinary. And I was listening to a report this morning that the president is going to continue to refuse to concede. He will continue to push out bogus conspiracy theories. He will still find lawyers filing completely meritless lawsuits as long as he thinks the Republican Party is going to stand by him. And as of right now, overwhelmingly, Republicans are looking at this and going, yeah, we're kind of okay with this. Yeah, there's a coronavirus that's, raging across the land. We have, potential of real, economic catastrophe coming, and the president is sulking in the White House. But, that's okay.
Right. So there are a few things that are enabling this. One is that the president has spent a lot of time creating a zone of conversation in which truth is simply not a relevant variable. The second is that the, as a result of that, you can say all kinds of things like that, millions of Trump votes have disappeared, a proposition. It's not even for which there is no evidence. There is active evidence. There's a lot of evidence that this vote was conducted in a, mature, serious, rigorous fashion, and there are no substantial irregularities in any state. That's actually what the evidence shows. Yes. But you also have an environment in which large numbers of senior Republicans are, for whatever reasons, and I think that, you've talked about this endlessly and have thought more deeply about it than just about anybody. But, for whatever reason, people with very few exceptions don't call him on it. And so the consequences of behaving this way are relatively minimal for him. And in fact, certain advantages accrue by behaving this way. And so the result is that, you can actually have him living in an alternate reality in which, he's preparing for a second term. And of course, he knows it's garbage. It's not, he knows it's not going to happen. But half of the political world has to play along, or feels it has to play along, with this suspended animation in which we pretend that there is a contested election going on. There is no contested election going on, and it doesn't matter how earnestly or faux earnestly Mitch McConnell says that it's perfectly appropriate for the president to, assert his legal rights, and it's really rich to see Democrats who've spent time delegitimizing this presidency, call for respect for the people's right to vote. People can do that all they want. There is a certain reality that is extrinsic to their feelings about it.
Well, it's also interesting, watching how these court cases have been, moving ahead. They apparently won a relatively minor case in Pennsylvania, but in courtroom after courtroom, what they're discovering is that apparently Twitter claims don't necessarily hold up. And when judges press them, are you alleging fraud? Are you alleging that something, misconduct? And they all back off. So it is not happening. You actually said something that was very interesting, that that Trump has succeeded in creating. What was that? I wanted to write it down. It's creating a space in which truth is not relevant anymore. And it, you know, you think about the project that's been going on for the last 4 or 5 years, this annihilation of truth, where it's not just that you tell a lie, it's that you get to a point where the actual reality doesn't trump whatever fantasy you put out there. And I mean, we're seeing the consequence of something that's been going on for a very, very long time. And, you know, some of us worried, where is this heading? I mean, are people going to be able to lie and get away with it? It's actually almost beyond that. It's not that necessarily people even believe the lies. It's that whether it's a lie or whether it's the truth is sort of beside the fact, right?
Well, so yeah, I think that's right. So it starts with lies. This is much bigger than a lie, by the way. It starts with lies. The president has told X thousand number of thousands of lies, right, in his presidency. This blizzard of lies, right? And then you create an ecosystem that sometimes supports the lies, sometimes magnifies the lies, and always tolerates the lies. So that's step one. It is a small step from the blizzard of lies to simply creating realities of your own. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going on here, right? It's not that he's lying about the vote in Pennsylvania. It's that, though he is,
yeah,
it's that he's created an entire reality. And let's just describe that reality for a minute. That reality is one in which, first of all, he prevailed in the relevant states. He mm-hmm. got more votes than Joe Biden did in the relevant states. Number two, in this reality, by the way, there is zero evidence for this proposition.
Right.
Number two, that votes for Trump were discarded in these states. By the way, and he says we won big, right? Yeah. So we're talking about tens of thousands, or in Michigan's case, hundreds of thousands of votes were discarded or created for Joe Biden.
Well, let me just, this is the all tweets cap from yesterday. You know, report Dominion, this is the voting machine company, deleted 2.7 million Trump votes nationwide. Data analysis finds 221,000 Pennsylvania votes switched from President Trump to Biden, 941,000 Trump votes deleted. Okay, but this is completely bogus. His source on this is Chanel Rion, whatever, from One American Network Now. I mean, how bad is this? You know, even the guys from National Review are saying it's appallingly bad. And you have the Department of Homeland Security issuing a rather remarkable statement, all in bold caps, saying there's no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised. So this is just batshit crazy conspiracy. I just want to back up on all of this. But it's also then being echoed by people like, you know, Maria Bartiromo, and Jonathan Turley is on Fox talking about this. That's the mind-boggling thing, that you come up and you just spew this completely bogus, insane theory, and people go, well, we need to think about that.
We need to think about both sides. Teach the controversy, man.
What the hell?
Look, it is, once you have conditioned people to accept a lot of lies.
Yeah.
It turns out to be a relatively small step to condition them to accept an entirely different reality. And that's what they are being asked to do right now. And a shocking number of them are doing it.
You know, this is good. This is good stuff, by the way, Ben. Okay. So I never fully understood that quote from Voltaire until you know, today. You know, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. You know, that's kind of like boilerplate stuff in the past. It's one of those quotes that you learn and you cite. But, you know, that is the thing, is that we really are living in an era right now where you can make people believe absurdities. And it's, by the way, it's not Russian disinformation. This is the president of the United States who's pushing these absurdities. And so for the people who are going, oh, don't worry about it, don't overreact, you shouldn't be too alarmed, you know, yeah, Joe Biden's going to be the president. But there is a price to be paid for making people believe absurdities. And this is the long-term problem of all of this, because at the end of the day, he's not going to be president on January 20th. That's not going to happen. But you will have, what, 40% of the country who will believe absurdities or will be indifferent to whether or not the what is being said is absurd. And that,
you know, you,
there are real
you,
consequences.
You quote Voltaire, but there's another authority on audacious lying that we should consult on this. The relevant passage reads, "The big lie, in the big lie, there is always a certain force of credibility, because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily. And thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victim to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehood. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. So even though the facts which prove this may be so brought clearly to their minds, they still doubt and waver and will continue to think that there may be some other explanation." That is Hitler in Mein Kampf.
Oh my gosh. I was going back and forth between thinking it was going to be Hitler or Hannah Arendt talking about Hitler.
Nope. Yeah. This is Hitler. Him. I don't believe in Nazi comparisons. I'm not quoting Hitler to compare Trump to Hitler, but Hitler is an unusually good authority on lying.
So where do we go on this? So he's not going to be able to overturn the election, but I think we agree on the long term consequence. I think the medium term consequences are also significant about not going ahead with the transition. I think the possible disruption of the distribution of the pandemic vaccine is a huge issue, and the cynicism that it takes to do anything that would possibly jeopardize life saving vaccine is breathtaking. And that's another thing that we have accepted a level of political cynicism that is just really extraordinary. That I think there used to be the fantasy that in times of national emergency, we would, you know, we wouldn't play political games. We wouldn't be partisan. There's a line that we would go up to, but we wouldn't cross it. And now it just sort of feels like, yeah, if Donald Trump's feelings, you know, are going to be hurt, then we're prepared to burn down America.
I do think on this score, there is a very good piece of news, and it involves a name that we've gone 22 minutes into this podcast without mentioning, which is Joe Biden, which is that somebody is actually acting like a president here. Yeah. And, you know, Biden has been, you know, for a guy who's accused of being a gaffe machine, which is not an unfair accusation, he's been note perfect in his response to this. He's responded, you know, more in sorrow than in anger. He has not pounded his fists on the table about the fact that he's not getting intelligence briefings or that his transition team is not getting any cooperation from the incumbent administration. He has, made public comments about the American servicemen killed in the helicopter crash, which at least mm-hmm. I haven't seen that the president has done. You know, we actually do have this concurrent modeling of what the presidency is supposed to look like, and it is ironically from the president-elect, which the current president does not acknowledge as the president-elect.
This is a real problem, I think, for the Republicans who figure that they're going to be able to make a pivot at some point, and they'll acknowledge, and then, you know, everything will work out relatively normally. I'm not sure at this point what their off ramp is. What's the moment in which it will be safe for them to acknowledge Biden is the victor, if in fact Republicans have decided that Donald Trump is forever? and that no one has any future in Republican politics if you ever anger them. And the one thing about Donald Trump is he has no loyalty, and it doesn't matter if you've been with him, you know, 99 consecutive times, if you break with him at the last moment. So, I mean, you know, for a lot of these guys, they may not be able to, you know, make a pivot until what, January 6th, January 7th. I don't know.
So I've been wondering about this. So let's talk about a few specific dates and what happens on those dates. The first of them is November 20th, which is the day that, absent some court intervention, which I really don't expect, the state of Georgia will certify that its electoral votes go to Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. So if you're, first of all, if you're Donald Trump, you cannot really win without Georgia. So what does Mitch McConnell do on November 20th?
Yeah, that would be, there are a number of those dates. So
right, the next one is November 23rd.
Right, and then I think Wisconsin's a little bit later, but there comes a date when every single state will have certified election results, right?
The last major date in that regard is December 1st.
Wisconsin.
And on December 1st, the last of the battleground states will have certified their election results. So, you know, the result is that on, you know, by that date, it will be unambiguously the case that Joe Biden has the electoral votes he needs in order to be elected president.
Perhaps. So, because all you need if you're Mitch McConnell is if there's some pending litigation still going on. We just had a lawsuit, by the way, filed here in Wisconsin yesterday that actually asked the judge to throw out all the votes from Milwaukee County, Dane County, and Menominee County. Milwaukee and Dane being the most Democratic counties, Menominee County being overwhelmingly Native American. There's nothing subtle about this. So all you need to do is keep throwing, right? Keep throwing lawsuits.
Keep throwing out the black votes.
Well, that's true. Okay, so there you have that date. And then you have December 8th, which is the so-called Safe Harbor Day date, where you basically, you know, that's the date by which you need to resolve all the possible controversies about the Electoral College. You would assume that by then Mitch McConnell would say, there's the off-ramp. And if it's not December 8th, December 14th, right? That's the day when they actually vote. When all the electors get together in the states and they vote. So we've moved past unambiguous. What is the stage beyond unambiguous? I mean, it's like in marble on December 14th, right?
Well, I suppose you could say that members of Congress don't read the electoral votes until January 6th.
Right.
And so,
which is the day after the Georgia special elections.
Right. And so I suppose you could imagine that they could hang on until January 6th, and then the same members of Congress could, I suppose, challenge electoral votes in those readings. But there does come a point where, and I actually, as I said before, I would have thought we were long past it, but there does come a point where the logic of the situation and the automaticity of the situation becomes the cognitive dissonance between what Trump wants the situation to be and the reality of what the situation is become a little too glaring. And I don't know, you know, I understand if you're Susan Collins or Mitt Romney, we're already past that situation. But I do wonder what the threshold is for others. Are they going to not show up for Biden's inauguration?
Yeah, if there is an inauguration, I honestly don't know the answer to that because, you know, as you walk through in your piece, which I strongly urge people to get, because you look at all the various possibilities. Look, there's always the possibility that things spin out of control, that the unthinkable becomes the thinkable, and we don't know. I tend to be, I'm optimistic about that the process will work through, but I'm pessimistic about the long-term consequences of all of this, and for the reasons that you articulated before about the quality of our political culture has been, for anyone who thought that we would have any possibility of healing, I think the damage is great. However, you made another interesting point when you pointed out that we'd gone through 20 minutes of this conversation without mentioning Joe Biden's name. Can I say something positive about Joe Biden? Joe Biden is doing something really remarkable. He is actually trying to lower the temperature at a time when everybody else is running around with their hair on fire. I was actually on a cable show when we were talking about this, and somebody from the Biden campaign was on, and I should remember her name, it was Kate. And she was, with every moment that went by, I felt like my blood pressure was going down. So this will be among the most important things that Joe Biden does, you know, leaving aside the policy and the legislation, just simply calming the country down, lowering the temperature, telling people, okay, we're going to solve these problems. We're going to get it done. We're optimistic. And it's still so sort of jarring to see here's a president who actually wants to get things done. And every time he opens his mouth, he's not, you know, spewing out juvenile insults. So that's going to be, if I had to cling on to one sort of moment of optimism here on Friday the 13th, it is that Joe Biden really does feel like the right man at the right time for, you know, this situation.
I agree with that. I think he, he is relatively few people's ideal, you know, if you said who is the person who most closely represents my policy views, he is not that. If you say who is the most charismatic, you know, inspiring leader, he is for most people not that. You could go on the list, down the list of all the things he is not. But if you say who is the perfect person for this moment, the perfect antidote to Donald Trump, the perfect person to maybe unsuccessfully, but to give a real college try at leading the an effort at national reconciliation, and also to hold the public's hand through a series of concurrent crises, he is very arguably the perfect person for that role.
I agree. So can we just move past Trump for a moment? Talk about something else?
Sure.
Okay, I want to get your take on that speech that Justice Samuel Alito gave to the Federalist Society. And this is rather extraordinary. It felt like a very, very political speech. He warned of dangers to free speech and religious liberty. You know, talked about the court's ruling on the gay marriage case. Said some rather remarkable things about the coronavirus restrictions being a stress test for constitutional liberties. I see that Harry Lipman on Twitter is saying as politically partisan a speech as I've ever heard from a justice. What was your reaction? I mean, I was surprised that in this particular environment, a justice of the Supreme Court would have given that hard-edged and ideological speech.
Yeah, so a couple things. First, full disclosure, I have not read the speech itself. I have only read news coverage of it.
Same.
And I, you know, so this is tentative having, you know, pending the speech actually being as bad as the coverage of it seems to be, seems to portray it as. I found it very disappointing, honestly. Justice Alito is somebody who I have always, you know, despite my disagreements with, I've always found a low-key and quite intellectually serious interlocutor for ideas. He's somebody whose opinions I usually find something to take quite seriously in, even when I disagree with them, which I often do. He's a justice who has sometimes persuaded me of things. And I also think he's, you know, somebody whose demeanor and temperament is quite attractive among, you know, particularly in contrast to some of the other justices who, you know, can be bomb throwers in public. And particularly, you know, I admire the way, unlike Justice Scalia, he never tried to be a sort of public intellectual as well as a jurist. And all of that is a little bit damaged by a speech like this. This is, first of all, injecting himself into matters of political controversy, not merely public controversy, in precisely a time in which we're, you know, we are actually, you know, relying on courts to be dispassionate apolitical bodies, however fruitlessly. Secondly, you know, a lot of it, at least as I understand it from the news coverage, seems to me quite intellectually weak. I do not see the great conspiracy against religious free exercise that he seems to see in the coronavirus response. And I find that as unpersuasive when Sam Alito talks about it as when Bill Barr talks about you know, this as the greatest threat to liberty since slavery, or maybe including slavery. So I find it intellectually uncompelling, and I also just find it unbefitting a justice to get up there in front of. I wasn't a big admirer of Justice Scalia's road shows. I was not a big admirer of Justice Ginsburg's celebrity status, and I don't really think that in a highly politically charged environment, it's a good idea for justices to be out there in front of highly partisan audiences stoking flames.
And I'm glad you pointed that. He's not the first justice to come out and give sort of candid you know, speeches like this that could be construed as being ideological. Now I see one law professor who's saying that he's not surprised that Alito believes these things. You only have to read his written opinions to see most of them. So a lot of this is very consistent with things that he's put in opinions. What is surprising is that he decided to say them in this public speech that was live streamed over the internet, can be recirculated forever, and that he did it in this particular moment when people are looking at the Supreme Court. Is it going to be more politicized? Is it more ideological? And when there are questions out there about the legitimacy of the court. I mean, our thinking about the court is obviously, you know, evolving, you know, over time, and we just went through one of the stress tests with the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. I think it's not likely now that the court is going to make a decision about the election, but you know, isn't this one of those moments where the justices should step back and go, okay, in order to sort of protect our image and the institutional integrity of the Supreme Court, there's kind of time, moments when we ought to stand down and stand back. And this would be one of them, which, again, that kind of struck me that he chose this moment to give this speech.
Look, there are two models of modern justice behavior. The extreme of one is Justice Scalia, which is the out there, you know, fists bared in the public arena, you know, doing intellectual combat with the other side. And to varying degrees, others, you know, Sonia Sotomayor doesn't do that, but she, you know, she wrote a memoir. You know, others have participated in that too. It's not a conservative justice thing. It's a temperamental thing. Are you out there? The other extreme is David Souter, and to a lesser extent, John Roberts. You know, John Roberts makes almost no extrajudicial comments, except in his capacity as Chief Justice, right? He is his opinions, he is his formal statements as Chief Justice and head of the judiciary. I believe the latter model, and by the way, Elena Kagan does the same thing. She writes, oftentimes highly opinionated, very witty opinions. She can be biting in opinions, but she doesn't give speeches. She doesn't, you know, certainly doesn't go before partisan audiences. I have a strong preference for the latter mode of engagement rather than the former mode. There are many, many ways to, you know, if you want to be a public intellectual, if you want to give Jeremiad speeches about liberalism, you know, there are many things to do. You can become a columnist at the Federalist. You can, you know, I'm sure Rich Lowry would give Sam Alito a column, and I'm sure Fox News would give him a show, although he's not that personally engaging. You know, well, he's not that charismatic, but you don't have to be a Supreme Court justice. And I do think that the instinct to celebritize the justices is a bad one. And the instinct on the part of justices to play along with that is also a bad one. And I feel that across ideological. Mm-hmm. I would rather no justices write memoirs. I would rather no justices have movies made about them. and I would rather that justices don't, you know, become, you know, sort of avatars of political, symbols of political movements that stoke their own celebrity in the context of those movements.
So which of those models do you think that Amy Coney Barrett will evolve into?
So I honestly don't know. I don't know her. And, you know, I did not know her when she was a law professor. I do not know her as a judge. And so I'm not in a position to make a prediction about how she's likely to behave. And I certainly want to give her the benefit of the doubt on that. I don't want to suggest that people are likely to engage in conduct I don't approve of.
The way you're describing it, though, and maybe we should devote a totally separate podcast to this. And I'm looking at this new majority now that we have on the court, and you have the very sort of hard-edged idea, you know, conservative ideologues, right-wing ideologues, which would be Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito. And then you have the more institutionalist approach that seems to be characterized by Justice Roberts. I'm getting the sense that Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh are more in that camp, at least the style, not camp, but more likely to be in that style. So it's going to be interesting to see where. Okay, well, do you agree with me or disagree with me on that?
I think it's relatively easy to predict Gorsuch and Kavanaugh's behavior because they had long tenures on the federal appellate court bench. They both did some legal writing. Brett actually wrote a review of a book for Lawfare while he was on the bench. So, you know, but they was decidedly non-ideological in character, right? He wrote a review, very respectful review of a book by David Baron on war powers for me. I don't expect now. The difference that, you know, what happened to Kavanaugh, of course, he then gets confirmed and he goes to the Federalist Society and makes what I thought was a completely inappropriate speech. Again, also to the Federalist Society after his confirmation, you know, where he said he would kind of always remember who his friends were in a way that I thought was very inappropriate. I do think maybe there's reason to suspect that in the long run, he'll kind of revert to his mean, which is to say to be involved in bar activity and speak in the kind of speaking that you definitely want justices to do, which is, you know, speaking about law in a non-ideological way to appropriate audiences. My concern arises when the speeches become very political or become very ideologically inflected. And that's particularly a problem when they become very personal.
Right. So the court was in the news this week, and the conventional wisdom seems to be that the majority is not inclined to throw out Obamacare. Do you agree with that conventional wisdom? Of course, there was this, the argument about with the elimination of the tax on the individual mandate that the whole thing could fall apart. It does seem that whatever the judges rule, that they're going to sever whatever they throw out from the rest of the legislation. Is that your take?
So I would be stunned, really stunned, if the court ruled both that the residue of the mandate, which is to say that the taxing authority no longer supports that provision, and that the entire law is non-severable. I can't imagine there are any significant number of votes for that proposition. I mean, maybe one or two, but I never believed that the non-severability argument would carry the day at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's of course the easiest thing for the court to do. So, Benjamin Wittes, is there anything else that's on your mind that you're looking at or thinking about over the next few days?
Actually, I think we are at the high water mark, or maybe just past the high water mark of the delusion that, and over the next few days, we are going to see it collapse. And I am actually really looking forward to that. I think there is something very scary about the president putting the entire country through a delusion of what reality is, instead of accepting what before our eyes it plainly is. And I think the prospect over the next few days, as more and more Republicans face the music and states start reporting their results more formally. Mm-hmm. I noticed that Wisconsin is mm-hmm. in the middle of a recount. And so far, I think I saw that Biden had gained four
Correct.
Votes in the recount. The more this happens, the more the delusion of reality will collapse. And I'm personally going to enjoy that show.
From your lips to God's ear. Benjamin Wittes, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.